May it please the court, good morning. Patrick Collins here on behalf of Charles Campbell. I'm here to ask this court to reverse his convictions and remand for a new trial. Your Honors, I do plan to reserve 4 minutes of rebuttal time, if I may, and I'll keep an eye on the clock. The first issue on appeal is a legal error involving the court's inadequate analysis of the Getz factors when the court admitted evidence of a alleged subsequent bad act. In particular, the subsequent bad act was a unconsummated drug transaction which was alleged to have been planned for 6 or 7 days after the last indicted offense. And the state was allowed to put on a significant amount of evidence with regard to that alleged occurrence. What happened in this case is that the court failed to conduct a thorough Getz analysis and only held that the evidence was relevant and that it did not offend Rule 403. However, the court did not make a finding and did not conduct an analysis as to whether this subsequent act was even material to the issues involved in the case.
Didn't the trial judge talk about it going to the point of a plan or a scheme as a one of the Getz prongs?
Yes, Your Honor. The state did make the application that, as the state is required to in its proffer, identify which exception of 404B, and plan or scheme was the one that was advanced. And the court did find, I find, that it was evidence of a plan or scheme.
Well,
however,
is your point then that the trial judge in the analysis has to go through each of the Getz prongs and then show the negative, the ones that don't apply, or does the trial judge just find one that constitutes an exception?
One is sufficient, Your Honor. However, the trial judge is required to go through all the Getz factors when considering that exception.
Tell us where the analysis went wrong.
Okay. In this case, the court did not inquire into whether the subsequent non-transaction, if you will, was material and had independent logical relevance to any of the 8 indicted offenses. The last indicted offense was said to have occurred on October 26th. There were some phone calls which were wiretapped. The state's witness was being wiretapped, and as part of a plea agreement, he testified against Mr. Campbell, asking, "Can I come down and see you tonight? I need to see you tonight." He called a couple times. Finally, Mr. Campbell said, "I'm going to bed," basically.
Well, what kind of link to materiality do you suggest that the Getz analysis demands?
Well, with regard to materiality, there has to be some connection to an element of the crime being proved. And with what the state's proffer was, it was plan or scheme. In this case, I mean, this court has held in DeShields and subsequently that the plan or scheme exception has to do with scenarios where there's unique facts where the common plan or scheme would help the jury to understand the identity of the defendant, or otherwise the crime is inextricably intertwined with the indicted offenses, and as such, it's relevant to be brought in, whether as a prior or subsequent bad act. In this case, there was no proffer by the state, nor was there any factual basis to allege that there was a common plan or scheme exception that would have applied.
Well, and doesn't Getz also require a correlation to an element of a charged offense?
That's correct, Your Honor, and that is where the materiality part comes in, and I believe that was also the gist of the previous question.
The reason I asked that is because you mentioned one offense in particular that this couldn't relate to at all because of time. Here there were multiple charges and a great many acquittals, but what is your understanding of the state's theory on how this related to the element of any of the charged offenses?
Well, what the state proffered, Your Honor, was that it was relevant particularly to the last offense because it tended to show that there was a continuing scheme for these transactions to take place, Your Honor.
And with regard to that, how do you suggest the Getz analysis would work if you find, hypothetically, that it only applied to the last offense? When you conclude your Getz analysis, are you suggesting the trial judge should tell the jury, this is being admitted with regard to this element of this offense, or do you just let it in and the jury does what they want?
Well, I think this case probably cried out for such an admonition. However, the state offered the evidence as evidence of an ongoing plan or scheme, which took place over numerous months. I think the fact that the jury acquitted Mr. Campbell of six of the eight offenses, which were alleged to have occurred earlier in time, points out the fact, the crucial nature of the subsequent bad act evidence as to the last offense, the October 26th offense. So to answer your question, Your Honor, this is in all likelihood a case where a special admonition in the instruction specific to Getz could have and probably should have included an instruction use this information as to the last offense or the later offenses, but that wasn't what happened in this case.
What was the instruction that was given, the limiting instruction?
Well, it was very much in connection with the pattern Getz instruction, if you will. The court offered the opportunity for me to draft it, and I did. And what the jury was instructed was that they could consider the subsequent bad act evidence as tending to show the defendant's intent.
Is that the same as a plan or scheme?
No, it's not, Your Honor. And as I argued in my brief, what happened here is the application was plan or scheme. The court specifically held that it was plan or scheme, yet the jury was instructed as to intent. And as Milligan,
that was your instruction?
It was. I drafted it, and frankly, what happened is I used an instruction that from another case, and I didn't catch the term intent in there. There was a prayer conference. The state had opportunity to review the instruction. We went through the instruction. But neither myself nor the state nor the court apparently caught the fact that the instruction said intent. Now, the fact remains that the jury was instructed erroneously, and I'm not going to stand here and say that I objected to my own instruction that I drafted. I didn't. The state didn't either. And I think even if that portion of this case is not reviewed for legal error, but reviewed for plain error, I think it's manifest on the record that Mr. Campbell's substantial rights were significantly affected because the jury was told that they could consider the subsequent non-transaction as evidence of intent.
Well, with hindsight, how would you have drafted the instruction differently?
Well, I certainly lost my application to exclude the evidence, so I would have drafted the instruction as the Getz analysis was held on the record, which was the court found that it was evidence of a common plan or scheme. And I would have substituted the words common plan or scheme and submitted it to the state, and there could have been a...
Is it such a great leap to say it's can be considered as evidence of an intent to carry out a plan or scheme?
Why?
I'm wrestling with what is really the meaningful difference between intent and evidence of entering into a plan or scheme, other than the fact that intent is a specific element of the offense, and a plan or scheme to commit the same offense more than once isn't an actual internal element of the charge.
I think that
what
is.
What otherwise is the difference?
Well, first of all, before we move on from that, I think that is a huge difference because the actual statute requires a finding of intent. So that's the term intent, as opposed to any other exception, such as common plan or scheme, has much more meaning, I would submit, to a jury than does than because it's an element of the charge. However, it's without trying to get into the minds of a jury, that Your Honor asked the question, my opinion is that a common plan or scheme means that the jury could find that, well, they've done this a bunch of times before and they were probably going to do it again. That's what the evidence means to me. Well, the jury verdict certainly negated that notion because he was acquitted on the first six offenses. Intent
but,
means...
But if we're talking about common understanding, if I say to you, is that what you intend to do? Or I say, is that what you plan to do? Would your answer be any different?
I would submit that one is retrospective and one is prospective. Evidence of a common plan or scheme, the meaning, the connotation is more what has gone on in the past and what is likely to continue into the future. Intent evinces a specific intent to engage in this transaction on November 3rd after the last indicted offense, and the jury was allowed to consider that in its consideration of the indicted offenses. So I'm not going to say that it's a earth-shattering difference and the two things are complete opposites. What I'm saying is there are meaningful distinctions between the two, and the jury was clearly instructed in as to intent.
So the answer then is the jury got it. They weren't misled by the instruction because they found your client not guilty of six of eight offenses.
But they found the found Mr. Campbell guilty of the last offense six days before the subsequent bad acts evidence, and the state argued vociferously and numerously from open to evidence to close that, hey, he was going to do it again.
Well, you understand where I'm going with the question. What I'm looking at is a charge that you drafted because you had no other choice but to draft it as best you could, having lost your objection. I think we all understand that. And we want to make sure that it's an instruction that didn't confuse the jury and cause us to lose confidence in the verdict, which is moving into the plain error arena. I'm trying to get a handle on why we should lack confidence in this jury's verdict because the word intent was used in the charge rather than the Getz analysis language plan or scheme when we're talking about a future act relating back to a specific charge.
Two reasons, Your Honor. One, we've already covered, which is because intent is an element of the charge offense. Second, there should be heightened scrutiny with regard to 404B instructions because it is an element of the Getz analysis. The jury has to be instructed on the specific reason why the evidence was to be admitted only.
Right, you're gonna have to help me with heightened scrutiny. If this were a corporate governance case, I would get it. But what is the heightened scrutiny beyond abuse of discretion?
In other words, Your Honor, Your Honor is proposing a situation where can we find even under, especially under a plain error standard, that the jury was somehow confused or misled. That would be a general proposition. A more specific proposition is that Getz and its progeny themselves require that the jury be instructed as to the very specific purpose. And I think the Milligan case points out that especially when you're talking about non-charged post or prior conduct, there has to be a very specific the defendant is entitled to a very specific instruction as to how the jury may use that evidence. It's different than evidence which would be your, let's call it normal evidence, which would tend to prove guilt or innocence of the charged offenses. This is something that's outside, prior or post. So heightened scrutiny may not be the best choice of words, but I think...
Oh, I understand now what you meant.
Okay. I would like to, looking at the clock, I feel that I should move on to the second issue, which was the court, I would submit a combination of legal and factual error with regard to its admission of evidence from a end-user customer of methamphetamine to testify that the substance itself was methamphetamine in the case. Now, with regard to the legal error, basically the holding was that the Wright case says that lay witnesses can identify the substance as methamphetamine. That's not what Wright held, and Norman, which just came out last week, I think reemphasizes that. This court has not held that a lay user can establish that a substance was the illegal drug. And sometimes, if there's if the court finds that the person has significant experience with the drug and under certain circumstances. Legally, though, the posture of the two cases is very different. The Wright case, as this court pointed out recently, was a corpus delicti case. The court needed to have sufficient additional evidence beyond the defendant's confession. Here, there was no confession. The state had the burden of proving beyond a reasonable doubt that that substance was methamphetamine. From a factual basis, the Wright case featured an individual named Cannon who was a drug dealer. Wright had been his roommate for over a year. They had consummated many drug transactions together over a long period of time. Cannon was allowed to testify as his experience that what he sold was cocaine. Nobody complained to him about fake cocaine, and he was a drug dealer. This case had no factual hallmarks which would indicate that level of reliability. This guy, Mr. Kanich, had used methamphetamine in the past. He testified he had not used, I realize I'm in my rebuttal time, but I'm going to just finish the thought if I may. He had not used methamphetamine in over 6 years. He testified that the substance made him feel how he remembered methamphetamine made him feel from 6 years ago. He also admitted on his cross-examination that there could be other substances that made him feel the same way, but he didn't happen to be aware of any. That was it. That's not, I would submit, a sufficient factual basis for such a witness to be able to testify to help the case prove, to help the state prove beyond a reasonable doubt that the substance was, in fact, methamphetamine.
You want to save the balance of your time?
I do, Your Honor, unless there's any questions.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Madam Clerk, would you do me a favor or us a favor and step outside and ask the people that were making the noise earlier to calm down?
They may read my mind. It sounds a bit quieter. I won't turn your clock on.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Until she's back.
You can feel free to if you'd like.
Thank you.
May it please the Court, Mr. Chief Justice, Danielle Brennan on behalf of the state. In response to the appellant's argument that there was an improper Getz instruction and an improper, that the court improperly examined the proposed evidence that the state sought to admit in this trial, is the state's position that there was no error. Should Your Honors find that a Getz analysis was even appropriate here, that this alleged aborted drug transaction that was said to have was going to take place had the defendant not been arrested, should Your Honors find that that even qualifies for a Getz analysis, the Getz analysis and instruction given was appropriate and therefore no legal error existed. The state argued in its brief and supports the position today that it's not clear what this evidence was. The evidence that was presented at trial consisted of a telephone call.
Is it clear why the state wanted to introduce it?
It is clear, Your Honor.
And what was the purpose? What was this? How was this evidence going to advance the state's case, and with regard to what charge?
It was with regard to all the charges, all eight charges, to show the common plan and scheme that the defendant took, that Mr. Campbell took, in his ongoing relationship with Raul Morales to sell, to both traffic in methamphetamine and deliver the methamphetamine and sell in these future transactions. This evidence is relevant to show the relationship between Michael Kanich, Raul Morales, and Charles Campbell, and the relationship that the three shared and the process of how they went about trafficking and delivering this methamphetamine.
Pick any offense and tell me what element of the offense this evidence would establish.
And with respect to the trafficking, it would be did possess and did possess the methamphetamine, because it showed that Raul Morales went to Charles Campbell to get the methamphetamine. And with respect to the delivery of the methamphetamine, it was did knowingly deliver the methamphetamine, which shows, this evidence shows that Raul Morales went to Charles Campbell to get this methamphetamine. He went there, and on the prior occasions, Charles Campbell delivered. This evidence, this supposed subsequent bad act evidence, if the court decides to characterize it that way, shows that, again, Raul Morales went to Charles Campbell. He tried to get the drugs. Charles Campbell, in fact, said, not tonight, it's too late, using code language, but he did clearly say, not tonight. So nothing actually happened, which is why it's unclear that Getz even applies in this situation.
Oh, well, go ahead.
Help me understand why this was important to the state. You have a series of offenses that allegedly were consummated. And if we just look at the record, my simple question is, why was it necessary for the state to introduce evidence of a transaction that never was completed to prove all of the charged offenses?
For a number of reasons, Your Honor. Again, it does show the relationship between the parties, and the parties' actions were exactly the same. With respect to the October 26th, the last two of the charged indicted offenses, how that worked was Morales made a call to Campbell. Campbell, he said, can I come over? He went over. And then a couple hours later, he called Michael Kanich, said, I have it, let's meet. And the exact same occurrence happened on November 3rd. It was Morales called Campbell, except that this time Campbell said, no, it's too late. And 2 minutes later, he made that call to Kanich and said, no, it's not going to happen today. This is a case where there was no methamphetamine ever collected. We did rely on the lay testimony. Therefore, it was a largely circumstantial case, and this evidence was necessary, and it was material to show the continuing relationship, the common plan that these three people had to continue in this trafficking, delivery, and the ultimate selling of this methamphetamine.
Well, I'm having a little bit of difficulty here. If I understand you correctly, you're saying that you put in evidence of an aborted effort to buy and sell the drug, and you were putting that in to help establish that on the prior occasions they did in fact buy and sell the drug, right?
Yes, Your Honor.
So why isn't that the kind of evidence that should not be admitted, because it's being offered in essence to say, well, they did it once, they must have done it more than once, and so we're charging him with these X number of occasions of having trafficked in drugs, and we've got this other example to show you that, you know, here's one where it didn't work out, but it's to help prove that that's what they do. They traffic in drugs.
Because Getz tells us that an exception to the 404B prohibition allows us to put in evidence of a common scam or plea, common plan or scheme to show this behavior.
Well, but wait a second. Again, I'm probably mistaken here, but if the way a particular group of people deals in drugs is, you know, somehow very special, that they've got a process that they go through and one hands off to another in a particular location, and they drop things in a garbage can or whatever, and somebody else comes along with a garbage collector's uniform and picks it up, you know, maybe that would be, in my mind at least, the kind of common plan and scheme that would suggest being admissible, but what was so special about the fact that these people would make phone calls to each other and then deliver drugs?
Your Honor, the fact that it was so, what made it so special and so distinctive was that they used code. This wasn't a call that was, hey, I've got the meth, can you come over here and pick it up and I'll pay you $1,200 for it, I'm going to sell it to somebody. This was using code as in T-shirts, as in tires. Hey, I have a doctor's appointment, can I stop by? I now have the money that you owe me. That's what made it so distinctive. And given their respective relationships, That it was the code that made it so unique and so specific. Here, the state only had the phone calls showing this code for the October 26th. The November 3rd phone calls that showed, again, these parties using the same code and not specifically coming out and saying what they were doing, that's what shows the scheme. That's what shows that on October 26th, they weren't just talking about T-shirts. They were talking about methamphetamine, and it's the November 3rd phone calls when they're talking about tires again in the exact same way they did in the previous ones that lets the jury, that shows the jury that, no, it's not just adding on that, yes, these are bad people and they're going to continue selling meth had they not been arrested. It's showing the jury that they're continuing to use this specialized code, and that's how they talk to each other. The state submits that should this court conduct a Getz analysis, that this evidence was squarely relates to a fact that was in dispute. This wasn't a reasonable doubt defense. It was an I didn't do it defense. And Charles Campbell sat there and he testified that they were talking about tires. They were talking about T-shirts. He didn't know why Morales was saying he owed money. I didn't do it. So this is material to the ultimate fact in dispute. Did he possess and did he knowingly deliver this methamphetamine? And turning to and playing on Your Honor's question, this does go to the common scheme or plan, which is the second Getz factors. This shows that it was such an unusual relationship. The evidence was also, in the third factor, proven by plain, clear, and convincing evidence. Here, we don't just have testimony, but we have the actual tapes itself that were played. And this phone conversation took place a bit over 1 week after the October 26th indicted offenses, so it was not too remote in time to satisfy the fourth Getz factor. And last, the probative value of this evidence was strong, and it certainly outweighs any unfair prejudice to Charles Campbell, given that this was evidence of an aborted transaction, and the only evidence that we have of Charles Campbell's part is saying, no, I can't do anything tonight. Therefore, there's no question that the probative value in a circumstantial case heavily outweighs that. The jury instruction given, the state submits to Your Honors, should be examined under a plain error standard. This is because it was the defense who crafted this instruction. And while it may seem odd to have the defense object to their own instruction that they crafted, it is what is required. And should Charles Campbell be seen to have to not have waived this argument, which the state submits he has waived any argument.
Well, how do they waive? That's intriguing to me. The defense has already objected to the need for an instruction at all.
Correct.
And the only thing the defense is doing is when the court gives the defense the option of drafting it, they go forward and draft it. Well, okay. Maybe they didn't draft it as artfully as hindsight would allow them. But how does that waive an objection to the instruction at all?
Well, because, Your Honor, the defense did not inquire into any guidance, if there was problems drafting the instruction, and the court specifically asked, is there any objections? After the instructions were read to the jury, does either state or defense have a problem with the objection? And the record is clear that both parties said no. Therefore, should this court decide to look at this factor, it should be reviewed at a plain error standard at most. Here, this instruction passes the plain error standard because the court looked at it, the state looked at it, and while the state did not object, the state had no, neither did the court. Nobody found issue with this because the common scheme exception does encompass the intent. The common scheme shows their intent to continue on these acts. So if there is any error on the part of this instruction, it's harmless at most, and we know that, and we are confident in the jury's verdict because the two charges that the jury convicted Campbell on were the two where there was the strongest amount of evidence. So that's how we could be confident that the jury was not unfairly influenced by this evidence, because the jury was instructed. The instruction started out by saying you are not to consider this evidence as proof that the defendant is a bad person. And the instruction ended with that same language. The jury's verdict tells us and makes us confident that they did not take this information the wrong way. They were not misled, and they did not think that he had bad character in general, which is what 404B prohibits. If Your Honors have no further questions on this topic, I would like to move on to address Argument 2.
Well, I have just one question.
Yes.
You've suggested several times that if we do a Getz analysis, if we review the Getz analysis done, you keep suggesting that this evidence would have come in without a Getz analysis. Can you explain to me how it would have come in but for a Getz analysis?
Yes, Your Honor. This evidence is unclear as to how it should be characterized because there's no concrete event that happened. The evidence that was put in was simply the phone call from Raul Morales asking Charles Campbell, can I come by to get a tire tonight? And Charles Campbell says, no, it's too late. I'm already asleep. I'm going away the next morning. So nothing, in fact, actually happened. And Getz and 404B, they speak to actual events that have occurred. So nothing happened here, which is why this evidence is kind of in the gray area as to how to classify it. The state submits, on one hand, a 403 balancing argument, analysis would suffice here to say whether this evidence is more probative than unfairly prejudicial. Because nothing concrete ever happened, that's why the state is making that argument. However, in the alternative, what happened here is that if using a 403 analysis, the trial court actually did more. And they took the extra effort of going through the Getz analysis. And we know that they did do the Getz analysis because the state presented a letter to the court pre-trial, and the state did an analysis. And one of the very first lines that the trial court said when opening the trial is, I've reviewed the state's letter. So we know that the court did do an analysis. So should this court find, given the murkiness, that maybe Getz is the safer way to go, the court did do a thorough analysis.
Well, I don't want to dash your hopes for the future, but our view of analysis more often than not is more than the court saying, I've reviewed the party's arguments.
Understood, Your Honor.
On this last point, we're interested in the implications if the argument in your brief prevails for future cases. In this case, you say you never recovered the methamphetamine, and so none was introduced, and we have this lay testimony from the end user. The obvious question is, if we have an end user in future cases and it's recovered, is the state simply no longer going to call the medical examiner to say, I've tested this and it's methamphetamine, and if not, why not?
I would hope not, Your Honor. Certainly, if I read Norman correct, aside from the fact that Norman was dealing with a police officer, unless there's some reason, obviously the medical examiner's testimony is preferred.
I understand that. I guess more directly my question is, in this case, how did the state prove beyond a reasonable doubt that this was methamphetamine?
By the drug by Michael Knitch, who was a 15 to 20 year drug user of methamphetamine. The state submits that this case is stronger than what this court was presented with in Wright, in that in Wright, it was just the drug dealer who had never taken the cocaine that he sold and never had the opportunity to feel the effects. He testified that he hadn't had complaints from his customers, so he assumed that it was actually cocaine from that. Here we have actual more than that. We have a witness who didn't just casually use methamphetamine. He used it for 15 to 20 years, and he testified that he used it about 1 to 2 times each month for 15 to 20 years.
Did the defense counsel mislead us when he said the evidence was that he hadn't used it for 6 years before this event?
No, he did not, Your Honor. He had not used it for 6 years prior, but he had used it for the 15 to 20 years and then took the break for the 6 years, but testified on the stand when he started using the methamphetamine again in 2006, it had the exact same taste and the exact same effect that he had felt for 15 to 20 years
while
using it.
So he's young enough to remember what he was doing 6 years ago, huh?
Maybe,
Are you saying that we can take judicial notice and that there's no other drug except methamphetamine that would give you whatever the sensation is that you get from methamphetamine?
I don't know if that's what's required here, Your Honor. Michael Knitch testified that he was sure that it wasn't cocaine because of this numbing effect and the different effects. It's for this was a question that the jury answered in the positive, and the state submits that this is a question for the jury.
Well, it doesn't get to go to the jury until the judge determines that there's sufficient evidence to submit it to the jury.
Correct, Your Honor, and the judge did hear. Campbell had made a motion for judgment of acquittal, which was denied after the state's case in chief. And the judge, the trial judge, found that there was sufficient evidence from Michael Kanich's testimony that because he was an experienced drug user, he articulated the reasons, the bitterness of the taste. He articulated that it was so bitter, that's why he didn't chew it. He broke off a chunk and just ate it. And this taste was exactly the same. The effects were exactly the same, and he differentiated from the feeling of another drug. Yes, he did admit on cross-examination that he hasn't tried every other drug out there. But the statement said there was enough evidence here that the drug in question that was what was delivered and what was sold to Michael Kanich was, in fact, methamphetamine.
Well, let's go back to my earlier question. Let's assume the record is exactly as you described it. But in my hypothetical, some of the methamphetamine was recovered and submitted to the medical examiner, and it tested positively for methamphetamine. Is it your position that, given the evidence you described in this case, that in my hypothetical, it would be unnecessary to call the medical examiner?
No. If I'm understanding your question correct, I don't believe, no, Your Honor. It would just be additional.
But you would not need the medical examiner.
Oh, you wouldn't necessarily need the medical examiner if a lay witness can testify to it. The medical examiner's testimony is helpful, and it's difficult for me to say, I feel uncomfortable saying it's the better evidence. But certainly if there's a test that says this drug is absolutely what it purports it to be versus the lay testimony, as a trial attorney, I would certainly prefer to call the medical examiner. If there was any question with the medical examiner's report, the lay witness may help give credence to that.
The question before the court, stated somewhat succinctly, is if we're going to convict people of using methamphetamine, how do we prove what was involved was methamphetamine? Your answer seems to be, well, if we recover some methamphetamine, we can have it tested by the medical examiner. But if we don't, we can just call an end user, and either way, we can convict the person beyond a reasonable doubt of using, distributing whatever methamphetamine.
Your Honor, I do see that my time is up. If I may continue to answer your question. Thank you. If the drugs are not recovered, then the right case certainly says that a lay witness can testify to what the drugs are. It's just two alternative ways of proving beyond a reasonable doubt what the drugs actually were, what the substance was, and that it was methamphetamine. So, yes, the state's position is that a lay witness can testify to it beyond a reasonable doubt, and so can a medical examiner's.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I think what the state just argued with regard to the Getz analysis was that there was no concrete event that happened, which is something I wholeheartedly agree with, which is what brings the plain, clear, and conclusive prong into play. The court found that the evidence was relevant and does not offend 404B. However, the court never made a finding that the evidence was established by plain, clear, and conclusive evidence. And from what I'm hearing from the state, which I agree to a lot of, is there wasn't much evidence of this theoretical transaction that was going to take place. One thing that happened is Mr. Campbell went off on a trip the next day and a search warrant was executed at his house among 16 other locations, and no methamphetamine was found. So if he's a guy who's got methamphetamine to deliver to this drug dealer, where is it? There was a search warrant conducted. So I would actually argue that the evidence was actually stronger that there was no proposed transaction to take place, that it was just a phone call. The state did not need Getz evidence to make their point that they alleged that there was codes used in these phone calls when someone said, I'd like a T-shirt. They're actually saying, I'd like an ounce of methamphetamine or something like that. That was replete. The trial was replete with all that. There was no there was nothing gained in that respect from the subsequent evidence.
Well, if that's all that came in, then why are we here? Why are we worried about it?
Pardon me, Your Honor.
I missed something there. If the evidence was that there were a telephone call where code was used, and that was the evidence to support the theory that there would be a later drug sale, a delivery in the future, but the evidence was other that the trial was otherwise replete with that exchange of code, what's the issue?
Well, my point, Your Honor, was that the state has argued that subsequent evidence was very important to establish a plan or scheme because there was code used to try to make that subsequent transaction happen. My only point is that there was evidence as to the other alleged transactions that there was code used as well. Okay. The reason why we're here is that the defense is alleging that the subsequent bad acts evidence was admitted improperly and that the jury improperly used it to reach its verdict based on the instruction. That's the essence of the subsequent bad acts appeal.
So someone actually testified based on the telephone call exchange of code, we were going to conduct a sale on a later date.
Sure. There was phone calls played and there was Mr. Morales, the state's witness, came in and said, you know, this is what I meant when I was making that phone call. I see I have 12 seconds left, so.
Well, actually, you don't have any time left, but if you take a few minutes or take a minute to respond to the second argument.
Well, the Wright case is clear that if there is going to be an individual that testifies that a substance is a drug, the person has to be sufficiently experienced with the drug. That's not what happened in this case. What happened in this case was the court found, well, the Wright case was decided, so that means a lay witness can put on testimony. There was never any finding that this individual, Kanich, the meth user who had taken a six-year break, was sufficiently experienced with the drug. There was no finding sufficient to admit that evidence. And in response to Justice Holland's hypothetical, I would suggest that the court take a best evidence sort of analysis, and the best evidence is the medical examiner's report when drugs are seized. When drugs are not seized, I think the court's guidance is clear from the recent cases that there needs to be an inquiry as to whether this end user or dealer or whatever the person may be is sufficiently experienced with the drug to establish it, and that did not happen in this case. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Thank you, counsel. We'll take the case under advisement and assess.